KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Today, a Democracy Now! Global exclusive. We're joined in studio by Columbia University student, Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi, in his first live interview since being released after more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison.
It feels good to be outside of prison, but the sense of freedom for me to be free is to actually, for all of us to be free, not only myself. So my freedom is interlinked with the freedom of other students who are still detained and interlinked with the freedom of the Palestinian people. But it feels good to be able to come to New York City and to be able to hike, basically in the forests of Vermont.
Mohsen Mahdawi is here in New York for his graduation at Columbia. Then we look at the Republican push for sweeping cuts to Medicaid. By one count, over 14 million people could lose health coverage. Plus, the Supreme Court has just heard oral arguments about President Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. It's a case that could result in the justices scaling back the power of federal judges to issue nationwide injunctions. The court appears divided.
As far as I see it, this order violates four Supreme Court precedents.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's carried out its deadliest day of strikes across the Gaza Strip since it shattered a ceasefire in mid-March. Israeli attacks killed at least 143 people since dawn Thursday, according to health officials, bringing the documented death toll in Gaza to over 53,000, though thousands more are missing under the rubble and presumed dead. One in five Palestinians, some 500,000 people, are facing starvation, according to the United Nations, with Israel's total blockade of food, water, and medicine now in its 74th day. In Khan Yunis, 13-year-old Palestinian Reem Alznati narrowly survived an Israeli strike that collapsed her family's home. After her father pulled her from the rubble, she learned that many of her relatives were dead.
The entire family of my uncle has been martyred. May they rest in peace. How would one feel to see all their loved ones come out as remains from under the rubble? My cousin's name is Mena. She's 1 year younger than me. She was just with me yesterday night. I swear, she bid farewell to me and told me goodbye, as if she felt it.
The head of the UN Children's Fund, Catherine Russell, condemned Israel's attacks, writing, quote, "It's unconscionable that over 45 children have reportedly been killed in airstrikes in Gaza in 2 days. This should shock the world, but is largely met with indifference. Nowhere is safe for children in Gaza," UNICEF's director said. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers raided the Palestinian town of Tamun Thursday, killing 5 men after laying siege to a home in the village center. One of the men apparently burned to death, according to Tamun's mayor. The deadly raid came after a pregnant Israeli from a nearby settlement was shot and killed. In response, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, called for nearby Palestinian towns to be flattened, just as Israel has destroyed cities in the Gaza Strip. On Capitol Hill, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib reintroduced a resolution Wednesday to recognize the Palestinian Nakba, or catastrophe, the Arabic word, on its 77th anniversary. The Nakba commemorates the murder, dispossession, forced displacement of Palestinians during the formation of Israel. Tlaib's resolution was co-sponsored by 8 other Congress members.
There are days that I feel so alone in this chamber as the only Palestinian American serving in Congress. The dehumanization and the anti-Palestinian racism here is painful, especially when my colleagues remain silent on the starvation of children and vote to send more bombs to the Israeli government while they commit war crimes with impunity.
President Trump has wrapped up his visit to the United Arab Emirates. After touting over $200 billion in investment deals with the Gulf nation on the last leg of his Middle East tour, the latest deals include Emirati investments in artificial intelligence, including the construction of a major AI data center in Abu Dhabi, which would import U.S.-made AI chips, likely from the company NVIDIA. Deals were also signed with Boeing and GE Aerospace. During his visit, Trump also referenced a promised $1.4 trillion investment from the UAE that he'd first announced in March. Meanwhile, Democratic lawmakers in both the House and Senate issued resolutions of disapproval over $3.5 billion in weapons sales to the UAE and Qatar. The lawmakers cited conflict of interest concerns related to Trump's cryptocurrency ventures, as well as the UAE's support of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces. As he prepared to depart the UAE, President Trump said the U.S. has sent a proposal to Iran over a new nuclear deal after multiple rounds of talks between the two countries. Details of the plan remain unknown, and Tehran has refused U.S. demands to give up its uranium enrichment program. Earlier this week, Iran's president condemned Trump's what he called bullying after the U.S. president accused Iran of sponsoring terror and fighting bloody proxy wars. This is the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian.
When he says we have missiles and bombs that are unimaginable, are we causing a bloody war, or are you the ones who came to give bombs and missiles to the countries of the region? Who wants countries to fight each other by giving these weapons, bombs, and missiles, and then claims that we are peace-loving, we want peace to be implemented in society? Did we destroy 60,000 women and children in Gaza in a year under the bombs and missiles they had? Did we cut off their access to food, water, and medicine? Are we a danger?
In Turkey, negotiators from Ukraine and Russia are meeting today for the first direct peace talks since shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. But expectations of major progress remain low after delays and uncertainty over whether the meeting would actually happen and after Russian President Vladimir Putin refused to attend in person. On Thursday, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky met Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Ukraine's foreign minister met with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Also Thursday, President Trump asserted, quote, nothing's going to happen until Putin and I get together, he said. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments Thursday in a case stemming from Trump's now halted order to end birthright citizenship, which is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. The Trump administration's challenging whether federal judges can issue universal or nationwide injunctions against his orders. The case is raising alarms. The far-right-dominated Supreme Court could hand even more power to the executive branch as Trump seeks to overcome court injunctions against his many executive orders. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime from the standpoint of the executive, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
The Department of Homeland Security has asked the Pentagon to assign some 20,000 National Guard personnel to assist with Trump's mass deportation efforts. It's not clear whether Trump would seek to federalize the National Guard, something last done to respond to the 1992 uprising in Los Angeles that followed the police beating of Rodney King. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baraka appeared in federal court Thursday over his trespassing case following his arrest last Friday outside the Delaney Hall Immigration Jail, where he was meeting with three congressional Democrats. Alina Habba, who is the interim U.S. attorney for New Jersey and Donald Trump's personal lawyer, faced boos from the crowd of Baraka supporters as she showed up for the brief procedural hearing. Mayor Baraka said he had to resubmit to a mugshot and give fingerprints again Thursday as part of an attempt to humiliate him. Baraka's trial is expected to take place in mid-July, a month after primary elections in New Jersey in which he's running for governor. Mayor Baraka spoke to journalists and supporters after his hearing.
Constitution of the United States. which gives everybody due process, no matter who you are, no matter what language you speak, no matter what your background is, what your gender is, or who you decide to love, that the Constitution protects everybody once you step foot on this soil, once you reside in this country, whether you document it or not, the Constitution protects you.
New York University, NYU, has come under fire for withholding the diploma of a student who used his commencement address to condemn genocide in Gaza. This is Logan Rosos delivering that speech on Wednesday.
The only thing that is appropriate to say in this time and to a group this large is a recognition of the atrocities currently happening in Palestine. The genocide currently occurring is supported politically and militarily by the United States, is paid for by our tax dollars, and has been live streamed to our phones for the past 18 months.
Logan Rosos received cheers and standing ovations from the crowd of peers and has been widely commended for his bravery. This comes as students at Yale, Stanford, UCLA, and the California State University system are continuing their hunger strikes to demand their schools divest from Israel and protect free speech on campus. Students have reported deteriorating health as school administrators continue to rebuff requests to meet. In related news, a new study finds more than 1,000 students across the U.S. were targeted, many of them penalized over their speech between 2020 and 2024. In Georgia, a pregnant woman who's been declared brain dead has been kept on life support for 3 months against the wishes of her distraught family because of the state's abortion ban. Adriana Smith, a 30-year-old mother and nurse, has been legally dead since February following a medical emergency. But doctors have kept her on breathing machines because her fetus, just 9 weeks old at the time of Smith's medical emergency, was old enough to have detectable cardiac activity. Adriana Smith's mother said, quote, "It's torture for me. I see my daughter breathing, but she's not there," unquote. And some 450 New Jersey transit engineers walked off the job early this morning, grinding services to a halt on the country's third largest commuter rail system. It's New Jersey's first statewide transit strike in over four decades. The president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen said, quote, "They have money for penthouse views and pet projects, but not for their frontline workers. Enough is enough," unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. Columbia University student, Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi joins us in his first live interview since being released after more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison. Stay with us. We've always been all right. We've always been all right, and kullu shi tamam, kullu shi tamam, kullu shi tamam. We're all gonna be all right, and kullu shi tamam, kullu shi tamam. As long as we try, we're all gonna be all right. Aha. Sinane performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Global exclusive. We're joined by Mohsen Mahdawi in his first live interview since being released after spending more than 2 weeks in a Vermont prison. Mahdawi is a Columbia University student, Palestinian activist who holds a green card. He's a legal permanent resident. He was arrested in Vermont in mid-April when he appeared for what he'd been told was his naturalization interview. After completing the interview, he ended up being taken away by armed and masked federal agents. Mosen moved to Vermont from the occupied West Bank in 2014, where he was third generation in his family, to live in El Farah, a Palestinian refugee camp. He later attended Lehigh University in Pennsylvania before transferring to Columbia in 2021 to study international affairs. At Columbia, he was co-president of Columbia's Palestinian Students Union and served as president of Columbia University's Buddhist Association for 2 years. Mohsen Mahdawi is one of several students who've been detained by the Trump administration. Former Columbia student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil has been detained since March 8th. Tufts PhD Fulbright scholar Rumeysa Ozturk was released a week ago after 6 weeks in detention. And Georgetown University scholar Badr Khansouri was freed on Wednesday after nearly 2 months in detention. Mohsen Mahdawi spent 2 weeks in a Vermont prison before a federal judge in Vermont ordered him released on bail. The judge, Jeffrey Crawford, compared the recent detentions of immigrant student protesters to the Red Scare and the Palmer Raids of 1919-20. This is Mohsen Mahdawi speaking to supporters just after his release, April 30th.
And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you.
Judge Crawford ruled Mahdawi should stay in Vermont but could come to New York for educational purposes. When the government objected, the judge responded Mohsen Mahdawi could travel to New York to attend his graduation at Columbia. The judge went on to write, quote, during his time in New York State, Mr. Mahdawi is permitted to move freely and conduct his daily activities normally, including but not limited to meeting with elected officials, speaking with and being interviewed by members of the press and media, speaking at public events, attending protests, the judge wrote. Mohsen Mahdawi hopes to begin graduate studies in September at Columbia's SIPA, that's the School of International and Public Affairs, but the Trump administration is still trying to deport him. Well, Mohsen Mahdawi joins me here now in our New York studio for his first live interview. Welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your freedom, Mohsen.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be with you, and good morning to your audience as well.
So if you can start off by telling us what happened, why you ended up going back to Vermont for this final, what you thought, immigration interview. What happened?
I mean, I was waiting for this interview, which is my naturalization process to receive a citizenship for over a year. And the reason I had to go to Vermont because my residence, my permanent residence, is in Vermont. Therefore, I went to basically what I thought should be a normal, naturalization interview. I expected at the same time that there might be a trap set up for me, just seeing and witnessing what happened to other students, including Mahmoud Khalil and Rumeysa Ozturk. And therefore, I was prepared for that interview, that I might come on the other side with full rights or no rights.
We interviewed Vermont Congress member Becca Ballant at the time, because you had written to her, she's the sole Congress member in Vermont, as well as to Senators Peter Welch, who visited you in prison, and Senator Bernie Sanders. You wrote them all because you were so concerned about what would happen?
This is exactly right. I mean, I prepared for many different, on many different levels. Part of why I stayed in Vermont is because of the support that I received from official representatives, such as the senators and the congresswoman, who I'm very grateful for. But at the same time, also, I had to arrange with my lawyers in order to have everything drafted, ready to go, just prepared for the worst case scenario. So I prepared with the lawyers, contacted my representatives, and contacted my community members who are very close to me. And we saw the aftermath of this is I was able to stay in Vermont, something that other students did not have the luxury to do. They were uprooted from their communities and from legal support.
So what happened? You go to the naturalization interview. What day was that?
It was on the 14th of April.
And you went with your lawyer?
I went with one of my lawyers, an immigration lawyer. We go into USCIS office. This is the immigration office where I'm supposed to have my interview. And everything looked kind of normal. There were some signs. The officer who interviewed me inside was waiting for us. And after being in the lobby for a few minutes, the lobby was emptied from any other applicants. So it was only myself, my lawyer, and my friend. And they looked at them and they said, this is the calm before the storm.
And so you had your interview? Did you sign any documents?
Yes, I went through my regular interview for citizenship to the point I thought that I am going to receive the citizenship that same day, because I was asked the questions that I had to answer. I answered the questions correctly. And then I was asked if I am willing to take the Pledge of Allegiance. When the officer asked me if I am willing to do so, I said, of course. And he asked me to sign a document saying that I am willing to actually protect and defend the Constitution of this country. And shortly after that moment, just within a minute, the DHS agents storm the office, separate me from my lawyer, and they say that I am under arrest.
Masked?
I mean...
Were they masked?
They were masked. They had hoods on. You could not recognize them. And they had guns on them as well.
And they masked around you? Did they handcuff you?
Yes, directly. Actually, there was not any space or room to show us documents or to explain anything. And they said, you're under arrest. So I gave them my hands and I said, I am a peaceful man. I am not going to resist.
And so you were taken. Where was your lawyer?
They prevented my lawyer from being with me. So I was taken through the back door into the lobby, outside of that building, into an unmarked SUV. And my lawyer did not know what's happening with me. In fact, at that time, all of what was going in their head is to basically execute the premeditated plan that they had in mind, which is to ship me, to send me to Louisiana. They had the tickets, the airplane tickets printed and ready. The agents had the tickets ready.
So they drove you to Burlington?
Well,
the airport?
Yes. So before they took me to the airport, they took me to a building to process me. And the processing, which we expected to take place in St. Albans at the prison, did not actually take place there. So I was surprised, very surprised. They processed me in a different building, separate building, only 10 minutes away from the airport. And then they drive me to the airport and they hand me to two other agents who are supposed to fly me on a commercial flight.
And what happened?
At that moment, I asked the agents, I said, are we going to Louisiana? And they said, yes. And I asked which direction. So I clarified that it's going to stop by New York City, then to Louisiana. We went into the airport and we realized that the flight was basically we were late. The flight was about to take off. The airplane was being taxied. During that time, I also was not feeling well, so I had to use the restroom for a brief time. And the moment I get out of the restroom, while we're walking towards the gate, we see the airplane being taxied away.
So your stop in the bathroom saved you from this plane?
I don't know if that is the reason, but some people think that this might be the reason.
When you got to the airport, you saw the plane pulling. When you got to the gate, you saw the plane pulling away?
Yes.
And what did that allow time for your lawyer?
I mean, if you think of it, that has changed the path of my legal my legal fight for justice. It allowed my lawyers to fight on fair ground and to free me within 16 days, something that other students, as you saw, weeks and months they've been in detention.
So you were held in detention in a prison in Vermont?
Correct.
With other migrants?
That's right. In this prison, in fact, basically ICE rents a section of the prison. And the section where I was, it was a mixture of three quarters of people who have committed the crimes before and one quarter of migrants who come in and out. And I was, my cell was C-38, the first cell in that C section where the migrants are. So I saw waves of the migrants. Those are not just migrants, those are the people who feed us, who plant our food, who harvest our organic, delicious Vermont produce.
Like the dairy workers.
And the
who
dairy
are detained.
Workers as well. So I was able to meet the first wave, which is farm workers who, you know, worked on farms, and the second wave was farm workers who worked on the dairy, in dairy farms.
Describe the conditions of your detention and what that brought to you, what that reminded you of.
Fabric is of injustice. You see them everywhere. I was prepared for worst case scenario. So to be honest with you, being in this prison was not as bad as I thought mentally. But the difficult parts was realizing this interconnectedness between injustices. It reminded me of my uncles, and specifically my uncle Abed. At some point when a guard shined the light through the squared window in the door, and the light was so strong in my eyes, and they remembered my uncle who had bloody eyes permanently. And then I thought...
Where was your uncle?
My uncle was imprisoned in the Israeli prisons, and now he's no longer alive.
He was
he
in the West
He passed away
Bank.
2 years ago. That's correct. He was born, raised, and died in a refugee camp, the same refugee camp where I was born.
Al-Farah.
Yeah, yeah. And I had this realization when I was there. I am now interconnected to three generations of my family. My grandfather, who was unjustly imprisoned, my father and my uncles, who were unjustly imprisoned, and my cousins, who were also unjustly imprisoned. And now I can feel their pain.
You also lost your brother, as well as other members of your family. Talk about where you were born. Talk about your family in the West Bank and in Gaza.
What I am doing here in America, this is exactly the question that I hope for the government to ask and to look into rather than just labeling me. What I've been protesting for is related to my firsthand life experience. As a child, I buried my own brother when I was 8 years old. He was 6 years old, and my brother faced serious issues. He was paralyzed because the Israeli army prevented my father from taking him to receive medical care. The camp was under siege. And then in the second Intifada, when it started in 2000, I was 10 years old. And I witnessed my best friend getting shot and killed in front of my eyes. And the pain of injustice that you feel when you see just a kid who you loved so much, his life being taken away in a second, is a painful experience. But that wasn't it, too. My uncle, on September 12, 2001, after September 11, my uncle Thayer, was killed on the hands of the Israeli army as well.
Where?
In Tammun, in fact, between Al-Farah refugee camp and Tammun, the same town that five people were killed. It's only 5 miles away, actually 5 kilometers away, about 3 miles away from the refugee camp.
The five people were just killed
That's
in the
correct.
Last day.
So it hits home. Everything that I am seeing and I am witnessing, I mean, in the second Intifada also, I lost two cousins. I was shot in my leg when I was 15 years old. And some people would say, oh, what was happening and why those people were killed? This does not, what matters is that children live in pain, in suffering, in trauma. And we have to see that for what it is. And we cannot just justify the killing, the murder, the continuous occupation, the apartheid, the genocide. We cannot justify it anymore. We either have to be pro-peace or pro-war. There is no third option. Enough is enough. So many people are suffering. And for me, many family members in the West Bank since October 7th, four cousins. In Gaza, more than 30 of my extended family. And I come here to Colombia, and what I do, I share my pain with the world. And I say, this is so painful. The war must stop. Children are suffering. The trauma is unbearable. And what they do, the American government and the extreme groups, the pro-Israel extreme groups, they want to silence me. They don't want me to grieve. They don't want me to share the pain. They don't want me to share the loss. They don't want me to ask for justice. It doesn't matter if I'm doing it in the most peaceful, non-violent way or not. They want to silence me.
You were president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association for 2 years. What made you become a Buddhist?
I discovered Buddhism when I came to America. And what made me become Buddhist is the practice of meditation and empathy that helped me with my pain and the trauma that I buried as a child. So when I came to America, for the first time in my life, I was provided with a level of safety to feel safe. And when you have that level of physical and emotional safety, the trauma starts surfacing. And Buddhism has helped me to center, to calm my emotions, and to be able to connect with the other, even my oppressors, even people who cause me harm. And this is how I started my journey and dive deeper into Buddhism until I led the Buddhist Association at Columbia.
Over these last few months, the protests that have taken place across the country, calling for the release of the detained students, like yourself, have been massive. And on April 20th, protesters gathered at Union Square to call for your release. The protest was organized by Israelis for Peace. This is Josh Drill, an Israeli-American master's student at Columbia University.
To deport someone like Muhsin sends a chilling message that peace builders are not welcome here. It derails the very path we so desperately need, and it actively stops Israelis and Palestinians from meeting. As a peace collective, we cannot allow this to happen. We cannot allow these deportations to happen. They threaten our future.
At that protest, I also spoke to the New York City controller, Brad Lander, who is running for mayor right now.
Somebody who grew up in a refugee camp in the West Bank saw a friend be killed by an Israeli soldier, and yet rather than turn to vengeance or pick up a rock or a gun, turn to Buddhism, becomes a peace activist and comes here and goes into synagogues speaking about empathy.
The controller running for mayor, Brad Lander, also Zoran Mamdani, who's running for mayor, has come out in support of you. What was that like? How did you experience that in prison?
It might be too cheesy to say that I have never felt as much love and support as much as I felt when I was in the cell. I was not able to see the full spectrum of support and of love and of protest, but I heard about some of the action that was taking place. And I have to say I was deeply moved by seeing the everybody who has mobilized and protested, but more specifically by the Israeli and Jewish community in New York City and in America, really like moving and raising their voices against my detention.
Also, Judge Crawford noted his court had received more than 90 statements and letters. I understand now it's well over 100 from Vermont community members, academic experts and professors, many of them Jewish, vouching for your character. What did that mean to you, Mohsen?
It meant that I am heard, that I am being seen, that my advocacy and work for peace and for justice did not go for nothing.
All of this is the Trump administration went after you, saying you promoted anti-Semitism. What did Secretary of State Marco Rubio claimed in a memo that the New York Times obtained that your actions could, quote, potentially undermine the Middle East peace process? Your response?
I'm not sure if they actually have a peace process. If they have a peace process, let them show us what the plan is. What we are doing is we are protesting and we are standing against war. We're asking for America and for the rest of the world to abide by international law and human rights as a first step. This government has been violating the basic principles of human rights and the basic principles that international law was established on. They're violating this country's own laws, the Leahy laws. And if they are accusing
me... The former senator of Vermont.
Exactly. And what they are doing, they're gaslighting the American people. And they are pointing the wrong direction. My response to this is listen to the peacemakers who we have. Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Muslims, Americans, everyone, and see the fact and the reality for what it is. What they're trying to do, they're trying to distract from the real issue, and the real issue is funding and supporting a genocide and dehumanizing Palestinians and seeing them as less of a value, don't deserve equal rights as everybody else.
Mohsen Mahdawi, can you talk about your dreams for the future, starting with next week? Class Day is Monday. I don't know if it was time for the 100th anniversary of Malcolm X's birthday, but that is Monday, May 19th. Graduation is Wednesday. What does it mean for you to be here in New York graduating with your classmates?
This is a long-waited-for journey. This is the seed of hope that my uncle Thayer has planted in me when I was 11 years old and when I was in deep level of pain after the loss and horror and the trauma that I felt. And he said to me, he said, after the Nakba, the 1948, we lost everything but our minds and our souls. And he said, education and hope is your only way and your path moving forward, because we have nothing left. And in honor of my uncle's spirit, I continued studying really hard until I made it to this point, despite of all of the obstacles with the Israeli occupation. And now what it means to me, it means that I can share this light of hope, not only with my uncle's spirit that might be hovering above us, but also with the children who are living in painful conditions in Gaza, the children who lost their parents, who lost their friends, their family members, who have been terrorized with all of the pain and the destruction and the bombing. I tell them that there is a way moving forward, and that way is education. Education is light, education is hope, and education is the path to move forward.
You're not only hoping to graduate next week, walking with your classmates, but then you want to go on to CIPA, to the Columbia School of International and Public Affairs Graduate School, where you've been accepted. The judge in Vermont says you should be able to be here in New York to continue your educational activities.
Yes, this is also to fulfill the dream that I have, the dream of peacemaking, of conflict resolution. This is the whole point I came to Colombia, and this is the whole point why I am going to study at CIPA. The American government, as it seems to me, they don't want me to continue my education. They didn't want me to graduate. and they don't want me to get my master's degree. I also have to share that what happens at Columbia University matters for the rest of America. The Columbia University administration, as I have been witnessing it, has been participating in the deterioration and destruction of the democratic system. They are not listening to their students. The students have, like the majority of the student body, have voted to divest from war any entities that are supporting the apartheid and the genocide. Columbia University administration is not listening. And in a matter of few days, I will be walking, and I would be walking with a conflict, mixed feelings. The feeling that I love this university that has given me tools to express my thoughts and to yearn and to achieve my dreams for freedom and for justice. And the other feelings that I feel deeply disappointed by the Columbia University administration. And I know that it's going to continue to be a struggle while I am going to be finalizing my master's degree.
As you and Ramesa Ozturk, the Tufts University student, and Badr Khansouri, the Georgetown scholar, are released, others remain detained, like Mahmoud Khalil, a judge in Vermont among those determining his fate. What is your message to those still behind bars and those whose names we don't know?
I say the same message, that don't give up, and don't give up on the idea of justice. Justice is inevitable, it's a matter of time, and don't give into despair. What we are seeing with my release, with Ramesa's release, and with Dr. Khan's release, those are light of hope, and you will be next, and we will be able to celebrate you very, very soon. The same message that the Gazan people have been sending to us, we're gaining strength from them to see all of the destruction, almost no buildings left in Gaza, no schools, universities, that I'm going to graduate, no more universities for students to attend or to graduate from in Gaza. A painful reality. They are sending us a message that there is so much more to hope for than giving up on the idea of justice and surrendering to fear and to violence. So I say, stay strong, and we will celebrate under the sun in a matter of a very short time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking this time to come to our studio in New York. Mohsen Madawi, Columbia University student, Palestinian activist, former president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association, was detained in a Vermont prison for 2 weeks. He graduates from Columbia University next week. When we come back, we look at the Republican push for sweeping cuts to Medicaid and the Supreme Court oral arguments on Trump's restrictions on birthright citizenship. Stay with us. Stereo by Radio Jarocho, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments on birthright citizenship. We'll be talking about that in a moment. But first, we're going to turn to the issue of Medicaid. The massive Medicaid cuts that are being proposed in the House. House Republicans have successfully pushed through proposals. For Medicaid and nutrition assistance cuts as part of Trump's budget, making his 2017 tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans permanent by taking away essential services for the rest of the country. The changes would disproportionately impact children and people living under the poverty line. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimates over 14 million people could be at risk of losing Medicaid over the next decade under the proposed requirements for recipients to work, volunteer, or be enrolled in school for at least 80 hours a month. For more, we're joined by Anthony Wright, Executive Director of Families USA, a healthcare consumer advocacy organization. Tell us, Anthony Wright, what have the Republicans come to at this point? What is this bill and the number of millions of people who will be cut off from Medicaid?
Thank you for having me. The proposal that passed the Energy and Commerce Committee just a day or two ago would cut $715 billion out of the Medicaid program over the next 10 years. It's literally the biggest cut to the Medicaid program in history, which would, just the Medicaid cuts alone, leave around 9 million Americans without coverage. And on top of other cuts and inaction and actions with regard to the Affordable Care Act, would leave about 14 million, at least 14 million Americans without coverage at the end of the term. So this is a massive cut. It removes people from coverage largely through bureaucratic barriers that get in the way of people getting on and staying on coverage. Things like having to reapply, not just every year, but twice a year. Things like work reporting requirements tend to be so bureaucratic that people who are eligible, who are working, fall off the program, but also increased costs in terms of co-pays and just additional cuts to states and to providers that mean that will impact the healthcare system that we all rely on.
I wanted to turn to the Republican senator, Trump ally, Josh Hawley. Among those, interestingly, criticizing Republicans who want to cut Medicaid, he was speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Well, the right thing to do is not to cut Medicaid, so I'm glad to hear him say that. Manu, it ought to be just a basic foundational principle. It is wrong to cut health care for the working poor. And that's what we're talking about here with Medicaid. My state is a Medicaid expansion state. Over 20% of Missourians, including hundreds of thousands of children, are on Medicaid. And Manu, they're not on Medicaid because they want to be. They're on Medicaid because they cannot afford health insurance in the private market. These are working people and their children who need health care. And it's just wrong to go and cut their health care when they're trying to make ends meet, trying to help their kids, trying to make sure that they're able to provide for their families. So I hope that the House GOP and the Senate GOP will get the message here. By the way, President Trump has said the same thing, no Medicaid benefit cuts.
So that was Josh Hawley actually speaking to Manu Raju on CNN. This is independent Senator Bernie Sanders calling the proposed cuts to Medicaid a, quote, death sentence for millions who rely on it. He was on MSNBC.
We're going to be looking at $715 billion in cuts to Medicaid and to the Affordable Care Act. That means, Chris, that according to the CBO, over 13 million Americans are going to lose their health insurance. And then on top of that, what the Republicans are proposing is a $35 copayment for many Medicaid recipients.
Right.
If you are making $16,000 a year, you know what? You can't afford that $35. You are not going to go to the doctor.
Senator Bernie Sanders, very interesting that Hawley sounds like Sanders, who is a close Trump ally. What is the significance of this divide in the Republican Party, Anthony Wright?
It is clear that there's many Republicans who understand the devastating impacts that this would have on their districts. Many House Republican members have 25-30%, and in some cases 50, even 60% of their constituents that get health coverage through the Medicaid program, and that would be cut. A lot of Republican members represent rural areas where rural hospitals will be particularly hard hit if one of the major financing streams is cut. But they need money to pay for the tax cut that they're trying to move through.
We're talking about a $4.5 trillion tax cut for the wealthiest Americans.
Right. They're going to pay for that part by increasing the deficit, but in part by making this massive cut, the biggest cut in history, to the Medicaid program, which is, again, a key funding source for the healthcare system we all rely on. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, maternity wards that all are at risk of scaling back services. Some may even close as a result.
So how are you organizing to stop something like 14 million Americans from losing Medicaid?
Yeah, so yeah, again, 14 million people will lose coverage, but they have been activated. There have been letters and protests of hundreds of organizations against these cuts. There was an all-night marathon session where Democrats were proposing a series of amendments against these cuts. They all were rejected, but there was protesters in the hallways, folks in wheelchairs getting arrested. There's been protests across the country in front of Congress members' offices making this case that we should not be cutting health care for low and working class folks in order to pay a tax cut for the wealthiest and corporations. And that's a message that needs to be breakthrough in the next few days, because literally they're planning to vote on this in the full House next week.
And the Republican message, as they're trying to hone it, as they lose around the issue of giving money from the poorest to the richest, they're trying to say, we're just trying to rout out fraud. Your final comment, Anthony Wright.
Yeah, I mean, they say that they're going after waste, fraud and abuse. But if they were doing that, this bill would look very different. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has been very clear. Millions of Americans would lose coverage. More people would have increased costs in their premiums and cost sharing, both in Medicaid and through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. And at the end of the day, we are cutting the hospitals, the clinics, the nursing homes that we all rely on. And that's why folks need to tell their Congress member what they think about these cuts in the next few days.
Anthony Wright, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Families USA, a healthcare consumer advocacy organization. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Supreme Court justices heard oral arguments on Thursday in a case stemming from Trump's now-halted order to end birthright citizenship, which is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. The Trump administration's challenging whether federal judges can issue universal or nationwide injunctions against his orders. The case is raising alarms. The far-right-dominated Supreme Court could hand even more power to the executive branch as Trump seeks to overcome court injunctions against his many executive orders. This is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system, in my view at least, into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime from the standpoint of the executive, where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
For more, we're joined by Andrea Flores, the lawyer and vice president for immigration policy and campaigns at Forward.us. Her opinion essay for the New York Times is headlined, "The Birthright Citizenship Case Could Split the Country in Two." You also have this piece, the other headline, "What's Really at Stake in the U.S. Supreme Court on Birthright Citizenship." What is really at stake, Andrea Flores?
So what's at stake is the definition of U.S. citizenship and also what it means to be an American. So American citizens, how do you prove that you are a U.S. citizen? You use your birth certificate. If the Supreme Court, grants the government this relief, if they narrow this injunction, then in half the country, the question of who is a citizen will once again be determined by the states. And, the last time that happened, that was the precursor to the Civil War. There's absolutely no plan by the federal government of how you would implement that or how you would prevent mistakes, discrimination. So really what's at stake is how we all define ourselves and to be a citizen and how we prove we're citizens.
So explain what's going on here, because two things are going on. You have the issue of birthright citizenship being debated in these oral arguments, but then you have the procedural stuff around whether judges can issue nationwide injunctions.
It's a really interesting case because there is this constitutional question around nationwide injunctions, which I've served in Democratic administrations and had policies that I've worked on be blocked nationwide, right? And that's been a burden for, you know, both parties. But on the other side, you have an executive order that attempts to reinterpret the meaning of the 14th Amendment, which has been settled law since 1898. So what does the government do? What does the Trump administration do? They actually, they don't want to lead with their worst argument, which as a lawyer makes sense to me. Instead, they did a series of emergency filings on that first legal question, which is, you know, are nationwide injunctions an overstep of a district court's authority? But by doing that, what they're essentially trying to do is find a backdoor mechanism to implement an order that multiple courts have found to be unconstitutional. They didn't argue, they didn't even defend their order as constitutional, because most would agree that it is absolutely not. And so, you know, the Supreme Court here cannot ignore that point. This is not a usual case. And I think you heard that from the justices. You know, you even heard Justice Kavanaugh say, ask, press the government on how would this even, you know, take place in 20 to 30 days, and they could not provide answers. So they are trying to use a procedural move. But in doing so, I want to point out, they really picked a case that made the best support for nationwide injunctions, right? Because if you split the country in two and you have a child born in South Carolina not be a citizen, but a child born in North Carolina be a citizen, that's going to be a catastrophe.
So I want to go to, I mean, the order now blocked by a nationwide injunction, but conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh pressed the Trump administration's lawyer, the Solicitor General John Sauer, for details on how it would be carried out.
On the day after it goes into effect, this is just a very practical question, how this is going to work. What do hospitals do with a newborn? What do states do with a newborn?
I don't think they do anything different. What the executive order says in Section 2 is that federal officials do not accept documents that have the wrong designation of citizenship from people who are subject to the executive order.
How are they going to know that?
The states can continue to, the federal officials will have to figure that out.
How?
So you could imagine a number of ways that the federal officials could.
Such as?
Such as they could require a showing of, you know, documentation showing legal presence in the country. For a temporary visitor, for example, they could see whether they're on a B-1 visa, which would exclude kind of the birthright citizenship in that country.
For all the newborns, is that how that's going to work?
So that's Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh questioning the Solicitor General, the Trump administration's lawyer, John Sauer. Can you translate that into lay terms? Brett Kavanaugh saying, what's going to happen to these babies born in hospitals around the country?
Well, as a former government official, it's stunning that they issued an executive order and then months later could not answer those questions. Because sort of as I write in my op-ed, the onus now will be on hospitals, it will be on states. Can you imagine a delivering mother having to also prove her immigration status or citizenship status in the delivery room? I think people are also underestimating like the maternal health outcomes and the fact that the Solicitor General wasn't prepared for how this would impact the community when they had filed and they treated this as an emergency. They treated it as though our Constitution, as it has functioned now since 1898, has been an emergency. So just to translate it, this government is not prepared. The administration is not prepared to do this. They just want the authority to reinterpret amendments. And you see them do the same thing for multiple amendments in the Constitution. The First Amendment, they are curtailing free speech by arresting international students. The Fifth Amendment, they are denying due process. They've disappeared over 200 people to a foreign prison. And now the 14th Amendment. And if the Supreme Court grants this relief, they will be emboldened. And I imagine we see executive orders on each of those fundamental rights. Which is why every American cannot dismiss this as an immigration case. This is a constitutional, really, test for the Supreme Court, and I hope that they do the right thing here.
Andrea Flores, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President for Immigration Policy and Campaigns at Forward.us. We'll link to your piece, What's Really at Stake in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.